and PGA award-winning writer, producer and director and co-writer and co-director of the film War Game, BBC Four, part of the Storyville season. It goes live tomorrow night. You're listening to Drive. Johnny Anson, Claire McDonnell with you. News is next.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
Here are your headlines at 6 o'clock on Monday, the 30th of September. Israel is reported to have told the United States it intends to launch a limited ground operation into Lebanon, potentially today. Earlier, the country's defence minister told troops they would use any means at their disposal to allow displaced people who fled Hezbollah rocket attacks in the north of Israel to return home. President Biden has been asked whether he was aware of Israel's plans.
I'm more aware than you might know, and I'm comfortable with them stopping. We should have a ceasefire now. Thank you.
In the last few minutes, we've heard National Education Union's members have voted to accept a pay rise for teachers in England. The government's offer offered an increase of 5.5%. An 8-year-old boy who died after being shot at a farm in Cumbria has been named as Jay Cartmel from Frizington. He was injured on land in the A66 on Saturday afternoon and later died in hospital. A man in his 60s who was being held on suspicion of gross negligence manslaughter has been released on bail. Professional dancer Giovanni Pannice says he's relieved that he's been cleared of claims he was physically abusive to his celebrity partner on last year's Strictly Come Dancing. The BBC carried out a review of his behaviour after the actor Amanda Abington said she was subjected to inappropriate, mean and nasty bullying. The corporation has upheld some of her complaints and apologised. Our entertainment correspondent Lisa Mazimba has told Drive it's been a troubling time for the programme.
Both sides, in a way, trying to claim victory, but I think the fact remains, and the headline is that 6 complaints, including complaints about verbal bullying and harassment, were upheld against Giovanni Pannice. And I think that's behaviour that everyone recognises is not permissible in the workplace.
Liz Truss has accused the Conservative leadership contenders of failing to acknowledge how bad things are for the party. Speaking at the Tory conference in Birmingham, the former Prime Minister said the 4 people running to replace Rishi Sunak need to think more radically about some policies.
I predict in the next 3 or 4 years, we will have some kind of crisis. It could be an energy crisis, it could be a financial crisis, but things are heading in the wrong direction. And what is the most important thing is that we are ready for that with the right ideas that are actually going to take this country forward.
Tom Tugendhat and Kemi Badenoch address party members earlier before James Cleverly and Robert Jenrick get their chance tomorrow. And Oasis have ruled out using dynamic pricing for the North America leg of their tour. The model caused anger among fans who booked tickets for their shows in the UK and Ireland earlier this month. Let's get your sport now from Delith Lloyd.
Hi again, Johnny. Arsenal defender Jurrien Timber says the current fixture schedule is dangerous and is a big topic in the dressing room. Timber, who missed the majority of last season with an ACL injury, says he totally agrees with Rodri's recent comments. The Manchester City defender has said players are close to going on strike due to the congested schedule. Bournemouth will move up to 11th in the Premier League if they beat Southampton this evening. Saints are still without a win in the top flight. We'll bring you updates on Five Live Sport. Manchester United are set to stick with manager Erik ten Hag for this week's matches. They're away at Porto on Thursday in the Europa League and away at Aston Villa on Sunday. The pressure, though, is mounting on the Dutchman after 3 defeats from 6 in the Premier League. They're currently 12th in the table. And India have set records for the fastest team 50, 100 and 200 on the fourth day of the rain-affected second test against Bangladesh in Kanpur. They needed just 3 overs to reach 50, 10.1 overs to reach a century, and they got to 200 in 24.2 overs.
In travel news, it's mostly weather causing problems, as in wet weather, poor driving conditions, mainly affecting the northwest of England, also most of Yorkshire. The M60 extra busy tonight, clockwise queues from 8 at Carrington to 12 at the Eccles Interchange, joining the M62, but it's extra busy tonight. The M74 Junction 10 at Lesmahago, heavy into the roadworks in both directions. The M57 Merseyside, Junction 7 at Switch Island, stop start there, taking about 15 minutes extra. If you're joining the back of the queue, that's on the northbound southbound side. The M1 queuing as well at 45. That's at Leeds Cross Green, heading north. Roadworks causing delays. Birmingham queues as well. The A38M looking slow, taking about 20 minutes. Heading out towards the M6 at Spaghetti Junction. It's busy on the M6 in both directions, either side of Birmingham at Junction 6. Then you've got queues on the M5 as well, joining the M6, taking an extra 15 minutes northbound. The A1M all open now at 34 at Blyth. That was an accident which has been cleared. And localised flooding everywhere, but also train problems as well. Not so much on the trains. You have got a signal problem affecting Middlesbrough services, though. Orna Merchant, Five Live Travel.
More to mention.
Enunciated beautifully.
Thank you. You really slowed that one down, didn't you? We're all very clear. It is Five Live Drive. It's Johnny, Claire, Delith, Orna. Great to have your company. Lots of reaction to the last interview with Tony Gerber, who has made this movie War Game with real politicians, people who hold public office in America. And it all came off the back of this op-ed in the New York Times from generals saying they're really concerned about infiltration in, you know, the National Guard and all kinds of setups in America, and not enough is being done about it. Texas saying this: what an enemy within. Trump called for peaceful protest to petition the government to make your voice heard. All legal constitutional activity. How is the BBC saying this drivel? We were quoting what the generals were saying in the New York Times op-ed. And they weren't caught flat-footed by January the 6th, says David in Belfast. Trump saw the danger. No one else listened. Dave, thank you for that. Keep your text coming in, 85058. Also on things that get damaged, and we just don't replace them. We just work with them Johnny.
Yeah, mend and make do, Claire.
Yeah.
Ed in Sutton, Surrey. I've got a 10-year-old kettle which now leaks when full, so I can only make one cup at a time. Real pain is when the family come around, but I will not bin it until it totally conks out.
Sounds a bit dangerous.
Yeah, but I get that. My toaster at the moment, this is the second time with this particular toaster that I have to stand there with the bread carriage lever, completely depressed.
Is that what you call it?
It's not what I call it, Claire. If you've never spent an evening studying schematic diagrams of toasters, then you haven't lived.
Okay.
It's the official name for it.
Yeah.
Manually holding it down so it toasts.
Right.
And having to let it go when I think it might be done.
Ah.
Very annoying.
Guessing game.
Yeah, it's a guessing game. Yeah. It's how I like to keep things really exciting in the morning.
But it must give you such an immense sense of satisfaction when the toast comes out, like, just how you want it.
Yeah, when you get it right. When you get it wrong, the frustration I cannot describe to you.
I know. You and I are going to leave the studio and get out more. 7:05. This is great. Pete in the city of Manchester. Evening, Pete. Evening, all. My treadmill gave up life over a year ago. I didn't get it fixed because the cost was, you know, more likely to be more than it's worth. So it's folded up. It's in pride of place in the front room.
Excellent.
Running the streets more these days, so no use for it. Hasn't got rid of it.
It's probably been used as a clothes horse.
Oh,
as well, isn't it?
Lives with it. You know, it's like an old friend. So the stuff that's got damaged, you don't check it out. It's just part of the family now. Maybe you still use it, as in Johnny's toaster. Tragic. 85058.
On BBC iPlayer.
He's our dog.
We made a mistake.
Please, not anymore. He's not, mate. Wake up.
The new series of Colin from Accounts.
Do we even need a pet?
We've got other stuff in common.
Do we?
What is your favourite kind of music?
Bubble grunge.
What is that?
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
So let's take you straight back to our top story this evening. Israel has informed the White House it intends to launch a limited ground incursion into Lebanon against Hezbollah, which could start as soon as today in the first public speech by a high-ranking Hezbollah member since its leader Hassan Nasrallah was killed on Friday. The deputy, Naim Qassim, said the group was ready to fight against an Israeli invasion.
The Islamic resistance will continue to confront the Israeli enemy in solidarity with Gaza and Palestine, in defense of Lebanon and its people, and in response to the assassinations of leaders and the killing of civilians. We recognize that the battle may be long, and all options are available to us. Should the Israelis decide to launch a ground invasion, the resistance forces are ready to engage with it.
His comments come as the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned Iranians that there's no place in the Middle East that Israel cannot reach as military strikes were launched further on Hezbollah in Lebanon. He made the comment in a video aimed specifically at the Iranian people.
I want to address you, the people of Iran.
I want to do so directly, without filters, without middlemen. Every day, you see a regime that subjugates you make fiery speeches about defending Lebanon, defending Gaza. Yet every day, that regime plunges our region deeper into darkness and deeper into war. Every day, their puppets are eliminated. Ask Muhammad Deif. Ask Nasrallah. There is nowhere in the Middle East Israel cannot reach. There is nowhere we will not go to protect our people and protect our country. With every passing moment, the regime is bringing you, the noble Persian people, closer to the abyss. The vast majority of Iranians know their regime doesn't care a whit about them. If it did care, if it cared about you, it would stop wasting billions of dollars on futile wars across the Middle East. It would start improving your lives.
Well, we can go to our BBC correspondent, John Donison, for the latest. He's in Jerusalem. John, welcome. In the last hour, we've seen US President Joe Biden repeating his call for a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. Hopeful, obviously, that will have some influence. But what are you hearing where you are?
I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think the Israelis are listening to the Americans or anyone. They are doing what they think is necessary to protect their citizens. President Biden and the Americans, the international community, have been calling for a ceasefire in Gaza for months. They've been calling for a ceasefire with Hezbollah for the last few weeks. But as I say, I think Israel feels it's got Hezbollah on the ropes and it is pushing forward.
So as far as the incursion goes, I mean, have we seen any significant movement of troops or have they been positioning themselves in recent days?
Over the past 2 weeks or so, there has been a troop build-up on the border. The Israelis are clearly getting ready for something. They've been training their forces up there. We think that at the moment there have been a number of very limited incursions using specialist forces, possibly going in to carry out intelligence operations. Some suggestion they might have destroyed some tunnels and Hezbollah infrastructure. But we've not seen any major incursion yet. It's going to come, though, I think. We heard from Israel's defense minister earlier today, and he was saying that an incursion could come within the next few hours. Now, I think what's important to remember, though, is it could be quite incremental and quite limited to start with. It may be that the Israelis go in one particular sector of the border, focus there before moving on to another sector. We don't know how far they're going to push in to southern Lebanon. I don't think we're going to see thousands, tens of thousands of troops crossing over the border across the frontier. It could be quite incremental.
And of course, this is a long history of invasions and incursions and then leaving again between Israel and Lebanon. But we are talking about Hezbollah, backed by Iran, who, you know, essentially, as far as warfare and capability are concerned, maybe in a much stronger position now to retaliate.
Yes, they have tens of thousands of fighters. They're very well trained. Many of them have fought in the civil war in Syria. They're very well equipped. They're a much more powerful force than Hamas in Gaza. They have strong military financial backing from Iran. That said, they've seen their leadership decapitated in the last few weeks. They've lost a series of senior commanders. There's going to be considerable disarray within the upper echelons of Hezbollah. But Israel is going to face resistance if they cross over, and it's much more risky than carrying out airstrikes on Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. So you'll remember back in 2006, the last time there was a full-scale invasion of Lebanon by Israel during the war that year, Israel ended up being pushed back and it lost a lot of soldiers. So there are risks, but I think, as I say, I think Prime Minister Netanyahu, he feels like he's got the boot on the throat of Hezbollah at the moment. It's popular with the Israeli public as well, what he's doing in Lebanon, and I think he's going to push forward.
John, thank you for the update. BBC correspondent John Donison in Jerusalem. Here, the UK government has said this evening that it's doing everything it can to help free Britons, get Britons out of Lebanon. Foreign Secretary David Lammy has chaired a meeting of the COBRA Emergency Committee to discuss the crisis. British ministers and officials have stressed that Britons should leave Lebanon immediately. Well, last week on Drive, we spoke to Dan Harper, a British national living in Lebanon with his family, and Dan joins us again now. Dan, tell us how things are there at the moment. Is there any news on when you can get out?
Yeah, we've heard from the embassy last night. I had a phone call and they said that they are now working on seats for British nationals on commercial options. And when we say commercial, well, it's only the national airline, Middle East Airlines, the Lebanese carrier, that's still operating from Beirut Airport with limited number of flights. And one of them being London, but we don't know whether it's going to be London or Athens or Istanbul, but they are working on getting us on commercial flights.
Given everything that's happened in the last few days, it must be an extremely worrying time for you and your family. What have you seen? What have you heard? How is life there now?
Well, I was driving around Beirut today. I had a couple of things to do, and life was as normal as possible. People are tense. They're not the partying spirit of the normal Lebanese, you know, looking forward to the next rooftop party or, you know, going out for dinner type of thing. That stuff has been put on hold, but everything else carries on as normal. And if you're not in the southern suburbs of Beirut, you don't feel too much in danger. But the situation is tense because people are worried how far the Israeli invasion will go, because I arrived here in the late 90s and, you know, Israel occupied part of the south. And when Hezbollah were glorified, really, for driving them out, they were probably at the top of their popularity that time. But I think now there's a different sentiment, especially in the non-Hezbollah areas, that, you know, this could be perhaps something that will change the stagnated political landscape within Lebanon for good.
Yeah,
so there is a little bit of optimism there. At the same time, it's bittersweet.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because we saw Netanyahu give this TV address where he's talking to people in Iran, he's talking to people in Lebanon to say, you know, you don't want to live under this regime. You know, weirdly kind of saying, like, we are helping you change things. Is that genuinely how people feel? They don't want to be under threat, but they want a different life.
Well, as you can imagine, he's not popular here. And, you know, where they could be doing some of the people here a favor, I suppose, in the sense that they're getting rid of their adversaries. And perhaps, as I said, you know, clearing things up for a future that Lebanon could, you know, prosper again. But I think the way that people feel is that this is just a really another blow to an already crippling economy, to an already very unfortunate few years after the blast and COVID and so many things. We've now got, you know, full scale war on our doorstep. And I think that's really worrying for all Lebanese.
Finally, Dan, I mean, you've been there since the 90s. Your family's there. I mean, obviously, it's an incredibly dangerous time. You want to get your family to safety. But how does it feel personally to know that you leaving Lebanon is imminent?
Well, I was just saying this to my family today. I said, you know, the feeling is, imagine you in your house in England had to leave tomorrow and pack a bag of a few things and you don't know when you're coming back. Well, it's the same thing. I live here. This is my home. And, you know, having to leave indefinitely is a horrible thing for me and my kids and my wife. But I mean, if it's for safety, if it's to protect them from being in a country at war, then it's got to be done.
Thank you so much, Dan. We'll check back in with you and we wish you safe passage. We hope you get out safely. Thanks for talking to us. Dan Harper there, British national living in Lebanon with his family. 18 minutes past six.
The Lebanon offensive has actually provided a boost to the popularity of Benjamin Netanyahu. His party is performing the best it's done in the polls since the October 7th terror attacks. If an election were to be held tomorrow, Netanyahu would win 25 seats in the Israeli parliament, making them the largest party. A few months ago, they were as much as 10 points behind their main rival, the centrist National Union Party. Professor Tamar Herman is from the Israeli Democratic Institute, which describes itself as an independent centre of research and action dedicated to strengthening the foundations of Israeli democracy. Professor Herman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tamar, what has this recent offensive, what has the Lebanon offensive done for people's perception of Benjamin Netanyahu and the government?
Let's start by mentioning that for a few months now, what's happening in the north of Israel is that most people usually living here were dislocated. They had to leave the area because it was always under the rocketing of Hezbollah. And people felt that the government was too soft on that, because it's part of a sovereign state, and more than a quarter of its territory was impossible to live at because of the rocketing of Hezbollah. And they thought that the government should be tougher on that. Of course, there are differences between center, left and right in Israel on these issues, how to make things better. However, on the right, we see a substantial majority who are saying that the military effort should be taken at least one step further. Not necessarily a ground operation, but certainly to make the situation for Hezbollah impossible, so they will make some decision whether to move to the north, across the Litani River or whatever. But basically, there was a very, I would say, medium support for a ground operation until this very few days. Mm. And of course, the Netanyahu supporters were more disappointed than the other, because they expected him to be tougher on Hezbollah. And now that this move with the elimination of Nasrallah was implemented, they are happier with him.
I'm just reading through some of your findings and the questions which you asked as part of your latest survey. And which of the following two options will better ensure the security of the towns in the north of Israel and enable all the evacuated residents to return to their homes? Severely downgrading Hezbollah's military capabilities and pushing it north of the Litani River is the most popular response. And I wonder how much you think that will influence or perhaps embolden Netanyahu to carry on pushing, and potentially so with this ground offensive.
Absolutely. It will strengthen him in his political camp, because they anyway wanted to intensify the military operation. However, on the left and in the center, there is no majority for the idea of destroying Hezbollah the way that he spoke in the past about destroying Hamas. They do not believe in that. And actually, at the center and on the left, they prefer getting to some kind of a diplomatic agreement with international, you know, involvement that will push Hezbollah away from the border. So we cannot talk about the entire Israeli Jewish public. Of course, the Arabs are even stronger in their opposition to the idea of any kind of a massive, more massive attack on Hezbollah, and certainly they are more in opposition to a ground operation in Lebanon.
And just finally, Professor, is there talk within the country about how much this latest offensive in Lebanon is perhaps a delaying tactic or even a PR tactic for Benjamin Netanyahu, who was doing particularly bad in the polls prior to the Hamas attacks, and whose public has responded very, very badly, saying he hasn't done enough to retrieve the hostages?
Not necessarily a PR move on behalf of Netanyahu, because he wasn't here. It was the IDF and the Minister of Defense who actually launched this massive operation in Lebanon. He certainly gets some points for it, but we, for example, see that the numbers of Israeli Jews who think that standing gallant, the Minister of Defense, whom it increased tremendously on the right of every center and left. They think that sending him home is a very bad idea. And okay. Gallant is perceived as a counterforce to Netanyahu in the government.
Okay.
So I would say that we should really pay very close attention to who is saying what and not looking at the entire Israeli Jewish majority group as a whole, because the differences are very, very striking.
Yeah, and of course, this is a survey, so it doesn't represent everybody. Professor Herman, thank you very much. That's Professor Tamar Herman from the Israeli Democratic Institute, 24 minutes past six.
In the next half hour, we'll be finding out if a round-the-world cruise trip will get underway tonight after being stuck in Belfast for the past 4 months. These passengers, understandably, are eager to set sail again.
Absolutely love Belfast, but we're happy to finally get on our trip.
We figured it would come sometime, but it is a little bit anticlimactic just because we thought we would go earlier. But we're thrilled. We're thrilled.
We are so excited. We've been here almost 4 months now, so we are ready to get on the ship.
I'll bet you are. We'll be speaking to cruisers. Is that the right way of describing them?
Who you're talking to.
Okay. I hope they don't mind. Gian Peroni and Angela Harasnyanyi in the next half hour.
And Hayley Campbell will be with us. Five Lives Must Watch podcast. Just before seven, we'll be reviewing the ITV six-part series Joan and Channel 4's Into the Jungle.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us on this network.
5 Live Drive.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now, this news just in, members of the largest education union have voted to accept the teacher pay offer of 5.5% this year in a snap poll. The National Education Union had already formally recommended that teachers should accept the deal, but the snap poll has confirmed teachers are backing this approach. Our education editor is Branwyn Jeffries. Evening, Branwyn.
Hello there.
This sounds like a pretty significant step forward.
It is confirmation in many ways of what we were expecting. So the National Education Union represents many teachers in classrooms across England, and this is about England only. It's the 5.5% pay offer made by the Labour government, accepting the advice of an independent pay review body. So that offer was made earlier in the summer. It got a warm welcome from both the NEU and the other main classroom teachers union, the NASUWT. The National Education Union leadership recommended it strongly to their membership, and they said they would carry out a snap poll just to make sure that they were in line with their members. And that has come back with an overwhelming endorsement of that position. So parents will remember we've had teacher strikes in the last couple of years. There had been the prospect earlier this year that those might be looming again with potential ballots. This confirms that teachers are accepting the pay offer for this year.
So the turnout, 41%, and of the 41%, 95% voted to accept. So how close are we to getting an official acceptance then?
This de facto is an official acceptance. It was highly unlikely that the membership would go against the recommendation made a couple of months ago of the leadership of the union to accept the offer, because it's usually the case that the national executive, the leading body of any union, will be taking soundings and will be in step with its membership. So this effectively means that the largest union has accepted the pay offer. What has also happened this evening is across government, and this, of course, includes the Department for Education, the letters have gone out from the members of the Cabinet to the independent pay review bodies for public sector pay. There is a specific body just for teachers in England which looks at things like the recruitment challenge, what other graduate opportunities there are that are tempting for people coming out of university in competition with teachers, and it recommends, on the basis of all of that market information and the supply of teachers and the need for teachers, what the pay offer should be. Today they got their instructions to begin that process for 2025, in which Bridget Phillips and the Education Secretary for England has spelled out that the government thinks finances are very tight. She doesn't put a figure on what the government thinks is affordable, but says there will be more details following the spending review, which of course will set out what school budgets are for the coming years.
This is the point, isn't it? Because whenever we cover this story, schools say, great, but where's the money coming from? And if it has to come out of school budgets, then you give with one hand, or you're instructed to give with one hand, and then you have to take with the other, that school children lose out because the government has said you have to give teachers a pay rise. So what confidence do they have that this money is not going to come out of their budgets?
Well, on this current year, the unions have accepted that broadly, that across, and this will vary, of course, from school to school, because schools are in different places on their budgets, there's slightly different funding levels depending on where you are in England, but that this is a funded pay offer, that additional money has gone in from central government to cover this year's pay award. That might lead, we'll have to wait and see, to a little bit of a tighter settlement for next year. But this was regarded by teaching unions as a fully funded settlement.
Branwyn, thank you so much for the update. Our education editor, Branwyn Jeffries. It is 6:30.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
And here are your headlines. Hezbollah says it's ready to respond to a potential ground invasion by Israel. The Israeli government's reported to have told the United States it's planning a limited incursion into Lebanon as part of its offensive against the Iranian-backed group. Police have named an 8-year-old boy who died after being shot in Cumbria as Jay Cartmell. He suffered injuries to his head and face at a farm in the Walkop area on Saturday. A man arrested on suspicion of gross negligence manslaughter has been released on bail. Members of the largest education union have voted to accept the teacher pay offer of 5.5% in a snap poll. The National Education Union had already formally recommended that teachers should accept the deal. And the former Strictly Come Dancing professional Giovanni Panici says he's relieved the BBC's cleared him of claims he was physically abusive to his celebrity partner last year. Some of the complaints made against about the dancer by Amanda Abington have been upheld, though. The actor's received an apology from the BBC. Your sport now from Delith Lloyd.
Johnny, thank you. Arsenal defender Jurrien Timber says he's in total agreement with Rodri following the Manchester City defender's strike warning and described the current fixture congestion as dangerous. Both Rodri and Liverpool goalkeeper Alisson have expressed concerns over playing too many games. Timber, who spent 9 months out last season with a knee injury, though, also revealed the increased number of matches is a big topic in the Arsenal dressing room.
To be honest, I totally agree with them. I think it's also like a big topic at the moment in dressing rooms, not only at City and Liverpool, also in our dressing room. But for me, what you said, I didn't play last season, so I'm just enjoying playing now. You won't hear me complain, but I totally understand what they're saying.
A South Coast derby in the Premier League between Bournemouth and Southampton this evening. What can we expect, Chris Wise?
Well, only one win between them so far in this Premier League season, and that belongs to Bournemouth, whose head coach Andoni Iraola won't be at pitch side tonight. He's serving a one-match touchline ban. His team haven't scored since August, but the worries sit far heavier with fans of Southampton. They're in the bottom three. A win here, though, will take them out of it. Russell Martin remains very calm about their situation, very reassured by what he's seen, despite Saints just getting that single point from their first five games. Windy night on the South Coast, and Saints could do with things changing direction.
Stay warm, Chris. Thank you. Plenty of updates throughout Five Live Sports. Newcastle boss Eddie Howe says he has his fingers crossed that Alexander Isak can be fit to face Everton on Saturday. However, the striker, who has a fractured toe, could also face the prospect of being sidelined until after the international break.
It was either going to be he was going to be out for probably until after the international break initially, or he could carry on playing as normal if he could tolerate the feelings and the effects of the injury. Now, he hasn't been able to do that, so we're back to the original diagnosis, I think.
Injury blow for Leeds and Wales. Midfielder Ethan Ampadu set to be out for the rest of the year with knee ligament damage. Leeds boss Daniel Farke says the midfielder won't need surgery but is expecting it to be at least 10 weeks before Ampadu can return to training. Germany women's captain Alexandra Popp has announced she'll retire from international football next month. The 33-year-old made her Germany debut in 2010. She's got 67 goals for her country in 144 appearances. And NBA Hall of Famer Dikembe Mutombo has died from brain cancer at the age of 58. The 8-time NBA All-Star, who retired in 2009, spent 18 years playing in the league. The 7'2" tall DR Congo-born centre led the NBA in blocked shots for five consecutive seasons and blocks per game for a record three consecutive campaigns. That's the latest from BBC Sport.
Your travel news, your final update. The M6 really slow passing Birmingham southbound from 7 to 6. There was an accident, but it was being moved off the road now. The M60 clockwise, queues from 8 to 12. Extra busy tonight from Carrington to the Eccles interchange, joining the M62. The A38M also looking busy. That's northbound out towards the M6 at Spaghetti Junction at Junction 6. Stretches of road have been flooded, including Southgate in Wigan, the A577, quite a long stretch. Chester Road in Halton in Cheshire, the A56 partly blocked near the Darsbury Expressway, and there have been stranded vehicles. Derby Road, the A565, that's on Merseyside, both directions at Seaforth. Orna Merchant, 5 Live Travel.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
Johnny Anson, Claire McDonald with you. Great to have your company. More than a century of traditional steel making in Port Talbot ends today with the closure of Tata's coal-fired furnace there. We'll also see the closure tonight of the UK's last coal-fired power station at Radcliffe-on-Soar in Nottinghamshire.
Yeah, the site has dominated the area since the late 1960s, and writer and creator of the BBC One drama Sherwood, James Graham, grew up in its shadow. Of course, Sherwood is set up in a is set in a Nottinghamshire mining village, and reflects on the divisions caused by the strikes in the 1980s. James is leading a campaign to save the cooling towers and wrote an ode to them for Radio 4's Today programme.
I saw the industrial scene and I was affected by it. That's a quote from Lowry. Someone's always said it better than you ever could, so I thought I'd start with him. The painter who saw art in the ugliness of industry. To me, the cluster of concrete towers of Radcliffe-on-Soar tell me I'm home. And I am affected by it. The train north that rounds the bend, and there they are, jutting up proudly over the trees, like a greeting party of eight, welcoming me back to a place with all this heritage and history that we are so rarely, for some reason, ever allowed to keep.
Well, I spoke to James earlier. He was in New York and took time away from rehearsals for his new Broadway production with Sir Elton John and Jake Shears to chat to us. I took his mind back to the East Midlands and asked him why the Radcliffe-on-Soar cooling towers have had such an impact on his life.
Well, these towers have been on the horizon of my community my entire life. They've been there for 57 years. But I also think that they speak to a wider, longer tradition in this country that we all know about and we all celebrate, the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution that is such a key and vital part of our national story. And yet there are so few monuments to remember that by. And so it's not only that, it's not only like, why can't we keep something that is a testimony to a significant part of the heritage and the identity of communities like the ones in Nottinghamshire that I'm from, but also, frankly, I just think they're really gorgeous. I think they're just really aesthetically, they're so impressive. They're these majestic concrete towers that are higher than St. Paul's, higher than Big Ben, that loom over these communities. And if you speak to residents, they don't think of them as being these ugly modern impositions. They really symbolize home for so many hundreds of thousands of people. There used to be 245 of them across the UK. There's only now 45. We blow them up and knock them down by default without even thinking about them. And I just really, really hope this is a moment to have a bit of a conversation about, can we just keep at least some of them, please?
It's a key conversation, isn't it, to be having on the day that traditional steel making in Port Talbot ends today. Yeah. 2,500 jobs have gone in South Wales. I know the transition obviously has already happened in Nottingham, but the locals feel, as you say, they feel very strongly about this, don't they? There's a change.org campaign to actually fund the resistance to it.
Absolutely, and it is a significant day. It's been 142 years that We've been producing electricity that's been fueled by coal power. The very last truck carrying coal arrived at Ratcliffe on Saw Power Station a few weeks ago. And that's the end of over 150 years of history. And like, look, I think that's probably a necessary and good thing. I come from a mining community. I've written about this in dramas on TV like Sherwood. I'm very proud of that legacy. But I think we all accept we have to transition and move on to greener, better energy. No one's fighting to keep that. But I think there's absolutely no reason, as I understand it, why closing down and decommissioning the power station and using this site to develop greener energy doesn't mean that we can't keep these incredible towers as testimony and as a reminder to that really important link with our past. And as I've slightly wanged on and moaned about on social media a bit, I just think if these were anywhere else in the UK, if they were in the capital city in London, they'd absolutely stay and become a museum or a gallery or a hotel. There'd be flats built around them in that trendy way that happening around the gas canisters in King's Cross. I just get really annoyed that we don't get to keep our stuff up here. If you speak to the people in Sheffield, remember those amazing towers at Tinsley that used to rise up over the viaduct on the M1? If you were driving north on the M1, up until 2008, you got to see and fly by these incredible towers that symbolized you were in a different part of the country with all this history. And they got blown up and knocked down over a decade ago. And the people just can't believe that they let them slip through their fingers, hence why I'm using this moment.
So you think there's a bit of north-south divide going on here as well?
I do. I don't think it's a conspiracy. I just don't think we think about it. I just think we, from communities like this, accept that we don't get to keep these vital moments of these vital physical reminders of our past. I'm really encouraged by a lot of the conversation from the new government about how we build new towns and think about building new places in this country. I don't see why we have to level everything to the ground in order to so-called, quote, level up the country. Why can't we be building around these towers? How exciting would that be? And I'm sure if they were in an urban centre that we'd be doing that.
Yeah, you've actually stood inside one of them, haven't you?
Oh, my God. It was incredible. Honestly, I've never stood anywhere like it on planet Earth. We did it for the first episode of the second series of Sherwood, and it was actually just the fortuitousness of timing. It was up the road at the West Burton plant, just quite near Ratcliffe-on-Soar. They're decommissioning as we speak. They're going to be blowing up and demolishing their six towers. But because we had a window of time when they'd stop operating, but before they were being knocked down, me and the film crew and the actors got to walk into them. And it's so hard to describe, but you stand at the base of this huge structure that does rise up higher than the Statue of Liberty. And they're engineering marvels. The way that you're sucked into them and your view goes up to this huge hole in the sky as you watch the clouds pass over. I really, really hope and wish that local people and, you know, school children and kids of the future get to do that. But at the moment, that's not going to happen. We're going to knock every single one of them down.
And when you put it like that, so passionately, you know, you're marking something, an industry that's past, which is important to kind of remember for future generations how we got here. But also from what you've just said, an incredible feat of structural engineering as well.
Yeah, they're so incredible. I think the ratio from the thickness, this is really nerdy, sorry, but like the thickness of the wall compared to the amount of space that they surround is the equivalent of the shell of an egg compared to the egg itself. They shouldn't really be standing up, but they do miraculously. And a lot of locals call them these elephant feet because they look like they've got a thick base and they curve up and then back out again. I think they're so gorgeous. And I don't see why either a museum or even, if this was in Manchester, there'd be some like trendy sushi restaurant in the middle of it or something.
Oh, yeah.
That you just get to like enjoy. Or if it was in Germany, it'd be like a nightclub or a rave warehouse. And because it's Nottingham, we're just going to knock them down without thinking about it. And I can't bear it. So yeah, fingers crossed a conversation can happen. If not about these, then about some of them. We have to keep some of them, surely.
And what do you say? I'm just going to read the statement from energy company Uniper, which owns the power station. They told us there's 125 staff would stay on to decommission the site, and the firm hopes the site would would eventually become a zero carbon technology and energy hub, and the cooling towers will only be demolished once decommissioning is complete. And your argument is, well, it doesn't have to be an either or.
Absolutely not. There's absolutely no reason why you can't use that site to absolutely transition into some exciting new energy hub. We desperately need investment in the East Midlands. Traditionally, the East Midlands has received the lowest amount of investment year on year than any region in the county. So I welcome all that. It was also, of course, meant to be one of the hubs for HS2 that would travel on that fork into the East Midlands. If that isn't happening, that also means that site where that station and that hub was going to be is up for grabs. So it is in transition. They still don't quite know what they want to do with the site. I see no reason at all why they can't. And I celebrate that they're doing that. I really do celebrate that they're going to transition to something greener and create jobs there. Why not have really, really cool, brilliant, exciting, sexy towers next to it? That would be brilliant. Why not do that?
Sounds like a plan. James, thank you so much for talking to us. I'll take you from the mental headspace of cooling towers in the East Midlands and let you get back to the bright lights of Broadway. You've taken a break. Have you kept Elton John waiting to do this interview?
No, he's not arriving until tomorrow, actually. So, but I've no doubt when I show him a picture of the Ratcliffe Onsor power station on my phone, he'll be one of the first to sign up to the petition to save them.
I bet he will.
I bet he will.
James, thank you so much for talking to us.
Cheers, thanks, Q.
And off he goes back into his rehearsal with Elton John and Jake Shears. What a life.
As you do.
What a talent, though. James Graham there, who is starting that campaign to save the Ratcliffe-on-Soar cooling towers, a landmark that is in a lot of people's hearts.
Some lovely text about this. My father worked as an engineer on the cooling towers, guys, and the chimneys of the coal-fired power stations. As a child, I went to see them in my own little hard hat. They're engineering miracles which have remained in my memory as I stood at the base of them and looked up. Please keep them. Yeah, they're miraculous pieces of architecture.
Yeah,
when you see them, just how huge they are. I mean, they are monolithic in size. Really, I agree that not just the memories, but the kind of repurposing them to use them as something else, and it's a really important lineage back to our past.
Absolutely,
which we should be keeping hold of.
Absolutely, we're kind of agreeing with him, but I'm sure we gave the other side.
But we're totally impartial.
But it is the point he makes about structural landmarks. Mm. That get preserved in certain parts of the country and maybe not others. But to have an advocate like James Graham is quite something, isn't
it? Yeah, and Rich in Nottingham, just on that as well. I grew up in a steel family in Sheffield, so I missed the Tinsley Viaduct Towers next to the M1, which for me, when I was driving back up from Weston-super-Mare up to the north, that was my sign that I was home. Those two huge big towers.
He mentioned it.
Next to the M1. Absolutely. I drive past the Ratcliffe cooling towers every day from Nottingham to Burton. They're iconic, so I agree with what you're saying, Rich, in Nottingham.
Thanks for all your texts. You can still text if you want. You've got about 15 minutes left. It is 6:45.
Now, after 4 months of being stuck in Belfast because their cruise ship was held up needing repairs, passengers should be boarding soon and are hoping to depart this evening. The Villa V Residences Odyssey was originally scheduled to leave on the 30th of May. A total of 125 passengers are expected to be on board when, all being well, it finally leaves tonight. Gian Peroni is one of them, along with Angela Harsani. And I'm really pleased to say they both join us now. Hi, Gian. Hi, Angela. How are you?
Hey, guys. Good to talk to you.
Doing great. Thanks for asking.
Now, are we right when we say that you two met on the ship and are now actually engaged?
This is a true story, yes.
Wonderful stuff. Take us through it, Janet. What happened?
Well, we both showed up here in Belfast back in May. As you mentioned, the ship was supposed to leave a little bit earlier than it has. We quickly became friends with a bunch of other people on the ship, and through a little bit of traveling back and forth, we ended up in the beginning of August starting to commute back and forth to the ship from our downtown Belfast hotels. And Angie and I, who are both avid outdoors people, obviously preferred to walk. And we created an amazing friendship that blossomed into a romance.
Oh, wonderful. Did he propose on the ship, Angela, by any chance?
No, he did not. We have not had a chance to be on board to do that, but he did engage, or he set my engagement for the walk that we did between our hotels and the ship, which was incredibly romantic and special on the night of the supermoon on the 17th.
Oh, wonderful stuff. So are you, where are you now? Are you back on the ship? Are you near to getting on the ship?
Not quite. We were actually over at one of the cruise ship terminals right now. We've got the whole 125 of us waiting for the ship to move from where the repair work was being done over at the Titanic slipyards over here to pick us up. We're scheduled to finally leave Belfast this evening. A bit bittersweet. We've enjoyed our time here so much, but we're all looking forward to getting going.
Yeah, I mean, Angela, it's an amazing place, Belfast, and of course, Northern Ireland in general. But when you were told that you wouldn't be moving for 4 months, what were your thoughts?
Well, we actually never got a heads up that it would be 4 months. Most of the delays have been kind of week to week. So a lot of us have chose to stay within the area and make the best of it. And but we've done a lot of great traveling on Villa V. They've definitely treated us to like Canary Islands, being able to go back and forth to Colorado to see my family. So it's been kind of a bittersweet, as John says, and it's pretty wonderful. I enjoy the community and the Belfast lifestyle out here with all the great pubs and culture. Yes.
Yeah. Amen to that. Gianna, I mean, a lot of people will say, how can you, are you retired? What are your plans? Because a lot of people would be like, how can you stay in one city for 4 months and then go on a cruise again?
No, I actually work full time.
Right.
The ship itself has a business center. I have an office I rent. We've, of course, been taking advantage of the hotel Wi-Fi. I bought several monitors on my travels and, we're making a go of it. Angie's got a travel agency business she started up. So it's working for us. We've certainly learned patience and perseverance.
Yeah. Yeah. So where is the ship going now? Where does the cruise head to? And how long are you on it for, Angela?
We have bought each our own villas, so we are scheduled to be able to cruise for up to 15 years. Gian and I have not decided if we find some location after the first circumnavigation, which is 3.5 years, if we will spend any time in one certain location, but kind of time will tell on that.
I mean, I love a good holiday. You know, if I can get 3 weeks, I am as happy as a pig in muck. 15 years, Jan, that's a massive suitcase you must have packed for that.
You know, both of us, you know, obviously we didn't know each other before, but, you know, we both sold everything we owned. And, I shipped everything from Canada in 3 hockey bags.
Right.
And, between that and a lot of Tesco bags, I think we're okay for a while.
Okay. Well, congratulations. Have a wonderful and happy life and cruise together. I mean, obviously you'll have booked two separate cabins, but now you are engaged. You could save half the money now, right? Are you still in two separate cabins?
Well, in theory, that sounds good, but I'm actually, my sister and I, Lisa, have planned a sister trip to go around the world together. So actually I'll be kind of splitting up my time between my sister and Gian. He's a gentleman enough to be able to share his new bride.
Oh, what a guy. I wonder how your sister feels about it. I guess that's a different conversation.
She's pretty happy for
is
me.
Is she? Okay.
We have to find her a
bloke.
There you go. Well, you've got 15 years to do it, so you should be lucky somewhere along the line. Have a wonderful life. Have a wonderful cruise. Have a margarita to celebrate. Take care, guys.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
Gian Peroni and Angela Harsanyi there, about to start a 15-year holiday. What a life.
I love the fact that he's gone away. It's such a bloke thing, isn't it? He's packed 3 hockey bags, yeah. 15 years.
A spare shirt. What else do I need?
A couple of pairs of pants. I'm absolutely fine. Now, it is 5 Live Drive. It's Monday, so it means it's time to catch up with either Scott Bryan or Hayley Campbell from 5 Live's official TV review podcast, Must Watch. And drum roll, it's Hayley. Hello, Hayley.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well. Now, I've seen your first choice, Trail to the Hilt, and it looks stunning. Stylistically, I am completely 100% committed to this programme, and I don't even know whether it's any good. Tell me about Joan.
So it's Joan stars Sophie Turner out of Game of Thrones, and it's a six-part series on ITV based on Joan Hannington's memoir, I Am What I Am, which was all about her experience of abuse as a child and her hardships as an adult, all of which led to her becoming Britain's most notorious jewel thief in the 1980s.
Right. Let's hear a clip.
Is there something else going on, Joan, that I need to know about? Is Kelly in danger?
No. Not at all. Just need a bit of a break.
It's okay. That's what we're here for, to help people in trouble.
And it's only till I find a new flat, and that won't be long, I promise. A few weeks.
We're gonna place her in a foster family.
Yeah, I wouldn't want her in a home. I was in a home as a kid, and it's definitely just temporary. I won't lose her, will I? Promise me I won't lose her.
Of course not.
Just to put that in context, that is Joan taking her daughter Kelly to social services while she tries to escape a disastrous, violent relationship. Hayley, is it a must-watch?
It is. And I don't know why we have that clip, because I don't think it's indicative of the whole show. It's really nice seeing Sophie Turner doing proper acting, and she's really good at it. And I don't think we got to see all of that in Game of Thrones. She had, you know, her character went through some traumatic stuff and she had to do all sorts of things. But all the while, she was kind of poker-faced royalty through most of it. And in this, she's switching accents. She's working-class London to RP. To American, all while kind of changing characters while she's becoming this jewel thief. And she's this doting but struggling mother to her kid. But as you say, it's the aesthetic of it, the outfits are incredible. Mm. When she starts coming into money, she's wearing this like amazing turquoise suit, and her eye makeup really got to me, because it was exactly the kind of eye makeup my mum taught me to do. Yeah. That sort of V on the side. It was bang on. Anyway, I thought this was a really good watch. Scott loved it too, as did Naga. So, yeah, this is absolutely a must-watch.
Brilliant. ITV1, 9 o'clock. Today, Monday the 30th of September. Indeed, it is today. Get home and watch it.
Right, what's next then, Hayley? Paddy and Chris road tripping. Tell us about this one.
Well, basically, like the title would suggest, Paddy McGuinness and Chris Harris go on a road trip across Europe to crack the code of aging well. That's the whole thing.
Is there any show that Paddy McGuinness isn't on right now, by the way?
I know.
Anything.
Can I just ask, why is it always blokes doing these road trips? Yeah. It's always blokes, isn't it?
Yeah. Because of cars.
Because of cars. You know?
Well, women don't drive.
Blokes like cars.
Yeah, exactly.
For
yeah.
sake.
Paddy McGuinness, the hardest working man in showbiz. Hey, let's hear a clip. In the first stop of their journey, Paddy and Chris head to Sweden and play ice hockey, having not been on the ice since they were boys.
We've got all the gear, but no idea. Still, no turning back now.
That's the fastest I've ever been.
Classic. Pads up front going for glory. I'm in goal-saving pucks.
Here we go.
All right, Paddy, you ready for this?
Push it back.
We're off.
Which way are we shooting?
And just like that, I've let one in already.
I've missed one.
But as the saying goes, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. I think I might have cracked the ice.
Oh, so is it must-watch, Hayley?
No, not for me. No, I think whether or not you like this one will depend entirely on how much you like these guys as personalities. Yeah. So you've got to ask yourself, how funny do you think Paddy McGuinness is? Because I think there's nothing revolutionary here. They discover saunas are nice, cold water swimming is invigorating, and access to nature helps with your mental health. Other than that, it's another celeb travel show. And it might be new information to the Top Gear crowd. I don't want want to make wild generalizations, but it just feels like stuff we've seen a million times before.
Okay. You can still watch it there if you want. Chris and Paddy, all three episodes road tripping on the iPlayer. And you can also see it on Sunday nights live on your telly on BBC One at 8 p.m.
And we don't have much time, Hayley, but the final review of the day, Channel 4's Into the Jungle with Ed Stafford. Who is he?
So he's an explorer and survivalist who moved his family to the jungle. And he also became the first human to walk the entire length of the Amazon forest.
Wow.
And basically in this show, he takes six dads who are hoping to become closer with their sons because, quote, testing yourself in an extreme environment is an amazing way of building relationships. And also because modern life is terrible and they'll all be away from their screens.
Oh, well, I don't know if we've got time for a clip, but does it work?
It's a bit, you know, I think the intention is good, but as a show, it's all stuff we've seen before. It's all, you know, trials in the jungle, and we've seen celebrities do that. So I found this one a little lacking. It feels like something I really wanted these families to do, but, you know, in private, away from my TV.
Just talk amongst yourselves. Maybe go to the local park. Have a walk with a dog. I mean, why didn't what's his name? Angry Chef.
Gordon
Ramsay. Didn't he do something similar?
They've all done this sort of stuff.
They've all done it.
Done it, yeah. Haven't they, for goodness sake? You know what they need in those commissioning rooms, Hayley?
What?
You. You in the corner. Going,
we wouldn't get
that.
Anything commissioned.
Yeah. Done that. Done that. We don't need to see that again.
Next.
Goodness me.
Not you again, Ramsay.
Come on. Bonding in a jungle, bonding on a car trip. Boring. Listen, thanks so much. And,
Thank you.
Have a lovely week. And you can hear Hayley and Scott with Nagam and Chetty on a brand new episode of the Must Watch podcast, which is now available on BBC Sounds. I always listen, don't you?
Yeah, you'd be mad not to.
There's too much choice and not enough guidance, and they give you that in abundance. Johnny and Claire on 5 Live Drive. We are back tomorrow at the same time. Coming up, it's 5 Live Sport Monday Night Club. Stay tuned.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 7 o'clock. This is Claire Ronacres. US media is reporting that Israel is about to launch a limited ground incursion into Lebanon. An unnamed American official has been quoted saying the cross-border operation could start in the coming hours. Hezbollah has vowed to keep fighting Israel and says it's ready to face any ground operation. Our correspondent John Donison, who's in Jerusalem, has more details.
I think what's crucial, though, is the scale and the scope of it. So this might be quite limited initially. It might be happening in certain sectors just over the border. They might not push in that far. I don't think we should be expecting thousands of troops to be marching across the whole border and pushing deep into Lebanon. I think it could be quite incremental.
The UK's top civil servant, Simon Case, has announced he'll step down as Cabinet Secretary at the end of the year on health grounds. In a statement, he said while the spirit remained willing, the body was not. Our politics correspondent, Harry Farley, reports.
Simon Case was appointed Cabinet Secretary by Boris Johnson in 2020. In a message to colleagues this afternoon, Mr. Case said in that time it had been an honour to serve two sovereigns, four prime ministers and more than 120 cabinet ministers. In January, Mr. Case returned to work after 2 months off sick, and he said he had been undergoing medical treatment for a neurological condition over the last 18 months. There have been reports of recent tensions between Mr. Case and Sue Gray, the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff. But in his letter, he dismissed the idea, saying it was a shame to have to spell out that his decision was solely to do with his health and nothing else.
Police have released the name of an 8-year-old boy who died after a shooting at a farm in Cumbria at the weekend. Jay Cartmell had suffered serious head injuries in the incident, which happened near Walkop on Saturday. More than 100 years of traditional steelmaking in Port Talbot has come to an end with the closure of the last coal-fired blast furnace. The owner, Tata, says it's committed to replacing the old furnace at the UK's biggest steelworks with a greener one that can only recycle steel. Around 2,500 jobs are at risk. Alan Davis.